Howdy, campers. This is Lauren Marie Taylor, and you are listening to the Not the Final Girl podcast. Hey, everybody. I've got a Halloween treat for you today. Susan Lanier, also known as Brenda Carter in the original The Hills Have Eyes, is our guest. Susan was plucked from her busy sitcom schedule by Wes Craven himself to star in one of his first directorial projects. On today's episode of the Not the Final Girl podcast, Susan talks to us about her experience with Wes Craven, as well as her early career on stage and in such iconic TV shows like Happy Days and Welcome Back, Kotter, just to name a couple. So happy Halloween to you all. Thanks for listening. Let's go. Susan, welcome to the Not the Final Girl podcast. It's just such an honor to have you here. You've had such a wonderful career, and I'm just thrilled being a big fan of yours.
Well, it's certainly an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. You were born in Texas, right?
I was born in Dallas, Texas, correct.
At what point did you figure out that you might be leaning towards an acting career? Were you dramatic as a child?
Gosh, I was so dramatic as a child. My mother was very beautiful, and she loved to watch the Miss America contest. And from my earliest, from when they first started televising it, she would line up all three kids and we'd have to watch this with her. And so I would get up and in front of my family and pantomime their different talents, making fun of them. And we get this amazing reaction from my sister and brother, who would be laughing and laughing and laughing. I found it so powerful to be able to get a response from my own family. So to see them react over some little thing I would say or do, mostly do. So I found the power in being in front of an audience probably at around the age of 3 or 4.
Oh my gosh.
Or maybe 5. And then always was writing little songs and little ditties. And then when I was 13, I auditioned for a play in a public park in my neighborhood. And I was 13 and I got the lead in the play. It was called Winnie the Littlest Witch, and it was put on by the city of Dallas. And then they did at the end of the year these acting awards, and I won best actress. And by the time I was 13, I was so smitten by the bug of acting. And then by the age of 14, I had been invited to become a member of a theater company called Theater 3, which was a professional adult theater company.
That's fantastic.
I was given some of the kid roles. So I was in Actors Equity at a very early age doing some of the kid roles. And that's back in Dallas, Texas in the 60s. So I don't remember a time really not being in the business.
Did you go straight to being a professional actress, or did you take time off to go to college?
I did a couple of semesters in Texas, and I got a lot of leads in plays, and so I was ready for New York, and so I just packed it up, and I was 17. I was just about to turn 18, and I moved to New York City and started acting in off Broadway things and studying at HB Studio. And so at that time, my parents were upset that I was in New York. So I did enroll in NYU, and I got a couple of more semesters at a New York university. It was always the classes scheduled around rehearsals. And I was working at a theater company called Nowhere East Theater, Gotham Village.
You loved the theater. What brought you out to Los Angeles?
I was actually had no intention of really coming to Los Angeles. Los Angeles growing up, I was just enamored with being on stage and abroad, and I could sing, so I wanted to do musicals. And I'd actually been cast in a national tour of Red Hot Lovers.
Oh, wow.
Last of the Red Hot Lovers with Pat Paulson, who was a serious regular on Laugh-In. And his team that was ICM, big agents, had come on the road to see who was this girl that all the critics were talking about every town that we went to? And so ICM came, sent a rep to the show, and they invited me to come to LA. I kind of started at the top when I moved to LA. Uh-huh. They repped me right away. They asked me to move, pack it up and move to LA. And honestly, the first week that I arrived in LA, I guest starred on Happy Days. So I didn't really have to pay LA dues. I must say I had paid plenty of theater dues.
So you did Happy Days as soon as you got to LA. Do you consider that your entree into this whole 70s TV universe? And what was it like? I mean, Happy Days, iconic.
I've already worked with celebrities in theater on the road doing back in the early 70s, a very, very popular form of entertainment was dinner theater.
Yes, yes.
And, every play had some Hollywood celebrity. So I had worked with also Ed Cookie Burns and, I can't remember the name of the play now, but, I'd worked with celebrities in dinner theater, which was a wonderful place for a young actor to cut their, cut their teeth on. And so it wasn't really anything that new. And I was so young that I just kind of took it all for granted. It was just part of the job.
Yeah.
I was well disciplined that in theater you learn your lines, you do your job. And I wasn't really aware of fame or money or things that could go along hand in hand with an acting career. I just wanted to act. That's all I cared about. So when I got on the set, I was actually cast in Happy Days by an old friend of mine from high school in Dallas, who was one of the producers who I had called because I knew nobody in LA. And I called him up and his name was Bill Bigley. And I called him up and I said, "Bill, hi, it's Susie from Lake Highlands. I'm in LA." He said, "Oh, well, come on over to the set at Paramount. And I'm producing a show called Happy Days." It was the first season. And so I said, "Sure." So I went over there. And Henry Winkler came up and he went, "Hey, I'm Henry." And I go, "Well, I'm Susan Lanier." And he, "Hey, Bill, make her my girlfriend." And they wrote me in that week. I actually had a date with him. Henry Winkler was my first date. And we were just good friends. And we had such a good time. He's such a nice guy. And he wanted to kind of show me the ropes, and he knew I didn't know anybody. And that was sort of how I got my first job. And then the agents were excited, of course, and they picked it up from there. And I was doing a lot of comedy back then. That's what I was used to doing on the road, and that's what I loved the best and still do.
Yeah, I remember watching you as Bambi on Welcome Back, Kotter for several episodes. I was so jealous of your waistline, by the way. Can I? I'm like, how do you get that? How do you get that waistline? I think I was doing sit-ups watching TV. But anyway, so Welcome Back, Kotter. You had a huge cast. What was that experience like working with actors who had that incredible sense of comedic timing for television? Because we know that there is a difference between stage and TV.
Yeah, I mean, one of the biggest differences, and what I think that maybe listeners aren't aware of, is that, you get your script, you do the table read the first 6-7 days before you shoot. So you do the table read and you think those are your lines. And so you go home and you learn your lines. So you're ready for your take. And back then, and I'm pretty sure they do something similar. I mean, the whole sitcom genre has changed drastically. Mm-hmm. From what it was like in the 70s, but you would do two performances, one at 5 and one at 8 p.m. And so you'd have two separate different audiences to see what works and what doesn't work.
Oh.
They would edit the best takes of the two performances. And what all through the week from your table read, you learn the lines, and then you'll go back to the set the next day and you'll see that the producers or writers have changed some of your lines. So then you have to go home and relearn the lines, and then But the hardest thing is that between the 5 o'clock and the 8 o'clock show, you know, you have a chance to maybe gobble down a tomato or something. And then you're in the makeup chair again and ready to places, you know, and then you're ready to do another show. In that couple of hours that you have between shows, the writers will often totally rewrite your whole part. And they did that to me on Welcome Back, Cotter. And it was so frightening to know that I had to make a memory adjustment. And so some of it, you just have to let come out the way it comes out because you've got a live audience there and you can't go back and go, you know, you can't stop. So you can't say, oh, wait, can I do that again? Now, the director might do that, but you are not allowed to do that as an actor. And so, you know, they put it together, and however they edited it, it seemed to work and was monumental in giving me one of my best credits that I ever really did in Hollywood was playing Travolta's girlfriend. And, you know, I recurred. They had offered me a more steady job there, but I'd been cast at the Amundsen to do Night of the Iguana with Richard Chamberlain, and Tennessee Williams was going to be part of that. And being a theater, you know, being just really interested in theater, I wanted my one chance to be able to work with Tennessee Williams. And so I turned Welcome Back, Cotter down to be able to do that theater credit.
And what kind of an experience was that?
It was amazing.
I can't imagine.
Richard Chamberlain, Raymond Massey, Eleanor Parker, Dorothy McGuire.
Oh my God.
And me. It was at the Amundsen. We had a long run. We had a lot of rehearsal. And it was just, an amazing experience. And, you know, one I don't regret. I do not regret turning down more television opportunities to have done that credit, because it was just very fulfilling for me as an artist to work with that cast.
Absolutely.
It was Raymond Massey's last play.
Oh, wow.
He really was a wonderful, incredible actor. And to do his last play, and we became friends, and he would write me notes if he saw me on TV, and he was pretty elderly at that point. And so it just the whole experience was amazing.
Do you have favorite roles that you played? Like, and I guess the second part of the question would be, do you find that the roles that you've played on stage that would be some of your favorites are very different than perhaps the ones you've played on TV?
Well, TV, to me, it is more stressful because the timing has to be perfect. Uh-huh. You don't get that many takes to make it perfect. And stage, of course, you don't get another opportunity if you mess up. But basically with stage, you're well rehearsed. You've done it over and over again. And basically, you have to remember your lines. I mean, that's the hardest part of doing it. A theatrical production. I feed off audience. I love to feel the heat and the energy from a live audience. I do a cabaret show where I write the music and perform stories or comedic things between songs and skits. And the audience somewhat participates. And to me, that is probably the most fun that I have on stage is when I'm singing and telling stories.
Let's talk more about that, because are the stories that you tell in between your songs, which I'm assuming are original songs, are they stories about your life and career?
Yes. I mean, I have a song that people like called If Roy Rogers Was My Daddy. And my father could be quite grumpy and wasn't at home all that much. He worked a lot. And so as a little girl, I would sit in front of the TV and watch the Roy Rogers Show and pretend that, you know, because Roy Rogers was famous for adopting all these children. And so I kept thinking, well, if Roy Rogers could just meet me, then maybe he could adopt me. His kids. So I mean, out of the blue, I don't know how crazy that is, but I tell the story of, I kind of tell the story about wanting Roy Rogers to adopt me, and it's a funny story. It's really, really funny. And then I sing the song, If Roy Rogers Was My Daddy. Yeah. And The audience loves that song and they get into it. And so all the stories are about funny things that have happened to me, and also, you know, tragic things that have happened to me, losing my late husband, mm-hmm. and, you know, heartbreak and, you know, life. I talk about the ups and downs of life, and that's mm-hmm. basically what life is, ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. Is your music more bluesy or jazzy with a hint of pop?
Blues rock, I would call it. My late husband is in the Blues Hall of Fame, Delaney Gremlett. Oh. We wrote a lot of songs together. There was a time where I put acting on the back burner to do music with him. And, you know, I still acted a little bit, but he had a couple of kids and I had a son, and we put them together and kind of raised them and uh-huh. stayed a lot in the music studio and wrote a lot of music together. And that was a really, really wonderful time in my life that I have no regrets. You know, acting is a great career, but if you put real life stuff on the back burner and not experience other aspects of what life is supposed to bring you, family and love and all those things, children, I think that at the end of the day, you end up not as fulfilled as if you'd actually lived life like a more normal person. I have friends that were always waiting for their acting ship to come in, mm-hmm. and it never did. And they died, you know, not feeling fulfilled that they ever got what they wanted out of life. And acting's a great career, but it's not everything to me.
You know, I'm so happy to hear you say that, because years ago when I was on a soap opera here in New York, I was on a soap opera for many years, and I worked with Jane Powell. And she was on the show, I guess, a few years after I got married. And I was hemming and hawing about starting a family. And she sat me down and she looked at me. She goes, honey, in this business, you got to do your family, because otherwise you never will. If you're talking about it right now, then now's the time to do it. So you go and you have your babies. Your career will always be there for you when you come back to it.
I mean, I think that's so important. And that was such great advice, because you know, I had back before IVF or whatever they call it, you know, before they could do artificial insemination, yes, yeah. stuff like that. I had a lot of actor friends, girlfriends who tried to get pregnant after they were 40, and those eggs just aren't as fertile.
Right.
And so they ended up either, I don't know, feeling like they'd missed out on motherhood. And, mm-hmm. You know, there's so many aspects of life that are important to live that have nothing to do with an acting career.
Yeah. This is called the Not the Final Girl podcast, but of course you were a final girl in the original The Hills Have Eyes. And can I just say, girl, can you scream?
Thank you.
Oh my God. But also that was a time in your early career, 1976, 1977, and you were super busy. How did you squeeze in filming such an intense horror movie?
Well, Wes Craven had seen me in Welcome Back, Kotter.
Oh.
And it was pretty much a direct offer to star in that movie, to play Brenda. We had our first meeting. I knew I wanted to work with him, and he knew he wanted to work with me. And I put everything else on the back burner until it was finished. You know, he gave me a rough idea of when we would start, and it was pretty much a done deal. My agent did not want me to do a horror movie. He begged me not to do a horror movie.
Right, because they thought it was a career killer, right?
Oh, they thought it would kill the career. And as it turned out, and I said, but I don't want to just do TV. I've done a lot of sitcoms. I was ready. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I want to star in at least one movie. And here was my opportunity. Now, what happened is The Hills Have Eyes. One could have looked at it as just another acting job. But my late husband saw The Hills Have Eyes at a drive-in with his then-girlfriend in 1977, and he had gone to the drive-in to watch The Hills Have Eyes. Don't ask. I mean, why would anybody would do that? I don't know, but he did. And the following night, after he saw The Hills Have Eyes, he was starring at the Troubadour in Hollywood with his fabulous band. And my girlfriend's husband was the trumpet player in his band. And she said, let's go hear Delaney Gramlett play. And I went, you know, I've got to work tomorrow. I was doing a commercial, and I said, I can't. Well, you've got to go. You've got to go. And I went, all right, one set. So we go, we travel from Studio City into Hollywood, and the light came. She said, I have to tell Daryl we're here. So she walks up to the stage with me and waves at him to let him know that we're here. He sees her, winks, and Delaney sees me. He comes down off the stage. He puts his guitar down right in the lawn, tells the boys to keep playing, and he comes down. He said, give me your phone number. I saw you in a movie last night. And so I gave, long story short, I gave him my phone number. And The Hills Have Eyes formed not only did I find the love of my life mm-hmm. through that movie, it gave me a whole different career in songwriting
yeah.
and having a band and performing something I really enjoy. And I, you know, The Hills Have Eyes was much more to me than just another acting job.
Yeah.
It was a life-changing experience. And I'm so glad that I didn't listen to the agent. And I'm grateful that it turned out to be a cult favorite and still has legs. But it meant more to me than any of that.
You know what I thought was funny was you teamed up with Michael Berryman, who was Pluto, right, in The Hills Have Eyes?
Yeah.
And you did a video with a song that obviously it's your song. You wrote it, you produced, and you directed it. Watch What You Ask For. How did you come up with that idea? And were you just lifelong friends with some of the actors? Well, probably a lot of the actors that you worked with.
Well, in that music video, Michael was my neighbor at the time, and Michael and his wife Patty and I hung out a lot. And I said, you know, I'm thinking of putting out a video to Watch What You Ask For. And he said, well, why don't you write me in it? And I said, okay. And the same thing happened with that lovely little Brooke Lewis.
Oh, yeah.
I adore. Brooke is the hardest working producer, director, actress that I know in this town. And she said, oh, well, put me in it too. And I said, all right, here we go. And so I just storyboarded it. And they, as friends, they just asked to be in it. We had the best time. I shot the whole thing in 2 days. I shot it in 2 days and then edited it in one.
Oh, that's so amazing.
I love editing. I love the other side of the camera. As well as being in front of the camera. I think I love being in behind the camera just as much. And there's so much creativity that can ooze out and ideas you can get while you're in the editing bay. And I just found it to be such fun. And I really made that music video in 3 days.
It's unbelievable. I mean, you're just the whole package of creativity because you do love all aspects of the work, of the job.
Yeah. I do. I love making the music. I love shooting it myself. So, I mean, I can't shoot myself, of course. Christoph Porter co-directed it. I gave him a co-directing job, even though, you know, I pretty much storyboarded it and he shot the scenes that I'm in. He's a wonderful, creative young man in L.A. And so nobody can do it all. I mean, you have to have a few people working.
Oh, absolutely. You need a couple more eyes on the project.
Yeah.
Aren't you doing another project with Brooke Lewis?
Yes. Brooke and I have a couple of projects coming out. She is a producer and one of the creators, I believe, of a sitcom called Stripped with Casper Van Diem. And that's a comedy. And I play a horny old woman named Ida. And that was fun.
Is that typecasting?
Yeah. And that we keep waiting for that to be picked up. But during COVID, Brooke and Joshua Butler came up with a project called Red Rooms. And it was something that we could all work from our own home. And so it really helped to know both sides of the camera, because Joshua directed remotely that project. We kind of walked through my house and studio, finding the right setup, as all the actors had to do. We found a good wall to shoot it against. And then most of that was an improvisation with the storyline going on and him directing us. It was directed remotely. We had to set it up. Mm-hmm. You know, we had to do wardrobe remotely. We had to do the scene remotely. We had to do the horror part of it remotely, the death remotely. It was really hard to do, yeah. But it was so much fun. And it really tested, you know, one's creative abilities. I don't know that, you know, a lot of people think that Hollywood's sort of like the old days where you just drive to the audition and you have the paper in hand and you read for the casting director and you get the part or you don't. Nowadays, you better know technically what you're doing. You've got to edit and film it. And all your auditions are called self-tapes. Yeah. And you really have to know what you're doing technically. And that has eliminated a lot of really good actors that I know who just can't grasp it. They just don't want to learn it. It's too overwhelming to them. And luckily, all along, I've been on both sides of the camera. So I took to it like a duck to water. But a lot of people can't do that, particularly older people.
Can I ask you one more question about The Hills Have Eyes, by the way?
Sure.
Okay. You were directed by the prolific Wes Craven, and your role, Brenda, spirals into a really difficult portrayal for a woman. How is Mr. Craven on set for you to be there as an actress for those difficult scenes?
Well, as you well know, films are not filmed in sequence. And so the rape scene, for some reason, Wes decided to make that the first film shot of the film, of the whole movie.
Wow.
Either his motivation was either to get it out of the way, to make sure that it worked. I'm not sure why he picked that scene to be the very first scene of the film to shoot. It certainly, thank God I had the theater experience that I had, and I know very well how to jump into character and make it real and make it work. You know, The Hills Have Eyes was Wes Craven's second movie.
Right. That was after The Last House on the Left, right?
Correct.
Okay.
And he had, prior to that, been a school teacher. So he had the patience of Job. Mm-hmm. And he was also extremely kind. He was so sweet and soft-spoken and appreciative of his actors, like hardly any director I've ever worked with. And so he was so much fun to please, because mm-hmm. you knew that he was a gentle soul.
Yeah.
And he wrote these horrific scenes, these morbid, horrible scenes, and yet he was the sweetest, kindest guy. And I feel so privileged to have worked with him. Well, that was a very difficult scene to do. And then later we did the out of the bed scene where they throw me on the ground and stick the gun in my mouth.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that was, you know, the whole thing was shot in 3 weeks. So I think maybe 2.5, I'm not sure. It was a very fast shoot. So it was not hard to find continuity, because, you know, it was just, I'd just done the rape scene, and then they throw me around the trailer and then drag me out, right, with my hair. A lot of the script was written exactly, and then a lot of it was improvised.
Okay.
And so, as you know, as an actor, you know, you start off with the lines, and if you don't hear cut, you got to keep going.
Yep.
And I think that he was Wes was lucky that he worked with actors who knew how to do that. Mm-hmm. Dee Wallace is a wonderful actress, but Wes could not have been cooler.
Were there any hijinks that happened on set?
Yeah. the producer, a couple of the producers were certainly more worried about the budget than their actors. Mm-hmm. And so they had hired a non-union stunt coordinator. You know, they were for those who don't know what a squib is, it's fake blood. It's a little packet of blood that they tape to your body, and then when they fake shoot you, then electronically there's a way to explode those blood pellets,
yeah,
that are under your clothes. And so the stunt coordinator had forgotten to remind Virginia Vincent to wear a bra, and they squibbed her belly where she would be shot by the shotgun. And it, when she doubled over to be, when she was shot, it damaged her breast.
Oh no.
And an ambulance was called immediately. It sort of reminds me of a little bit of Alec Baldwin's except nobody fortunately died.
Yeah.
And there were not real bullets allowed, thank God.
Yeah.
But that was her last day of shooting, and thank God most of her work was finished, because that was one of the last scenes, was her being blown to bits in the trailer. And she could never come back because she was, you know, wounded on the set, and that happens. She ended up being fine. I'm not sure what it ended up looking like, and it was horribly tragic. I adored Virginia, and it was horrifying because I was standing right there when it happened, and it was just horrifying.
Wow.
Things like that can happen on a set, though, and I don't know that everybody is aware of how dangerous it can be.
Yeah, especially if you don't have a really good stunt person involved to make sure everything is copacetic.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right, so we'll move away from that. Okay,
pretty dismal.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you a series of questions, and you can either answer them or you can take the fifth and just say pass, okay?
Okay.
Okay, do you have your most cringeworthy scene in any of your movies or on a TV show? Is there one that you can pinpoint?
I did a movie called No Solicitors with Eric Roberts, and I played a nurse or something in the scene, and somebody delivers a heart. And I thought that whole entire film, though I liked the cast very much, it was, the whole movie was pretty cringe.
You're the first person who's ever said that.
I literally could not watch it. I went to the opening and the red carpet, and I sat in the back and I went, okay, this is, let's go back to the theater. You know, I think we're done with this genre. So yeah, it just keeps getting cringier and cringier, and it was pretty cringy.
Well, you do like horror movies, though, right?
You know, I don't like to watch them. I'm not a horror fan. I like romantic comedies and lighter things, or great dramas.
So if you could go back in time and play a classic movie role, who would it be?
If I had been younger, I loved Kate Hudson's role in Almost Famous.
Oh, wow.
But I was way too old to be considered, you know, for that part. I auditioned for Carrie with Brian De Palma. I really wanted that part, and it went to Sissy Spacek.
Are there any other roles that got away from you that you wish you had booked?
Well, I auditioned for Robert De Niro for Once Upon a Time in America.
No.
With Sergio Leone. By the Elizabeth of Montgomery role, I believe.
Yeah.
So I met De Niro and Sergio Leone in a private room in the Chateau Marmont. They held proper auditions. Nothing weird happened. Nobody tried anything. And I got a couple of callbacks for that, but I didn't get that movie.
Now, obviously, you've worked with so many people in the business. You probably know everyone. But let's say you're going to a convention and you see the roster of other people who are going to be there. Have you ever fangirled anybody at a convention?
Oh, I'm trying to think. I went to high school with Morgan Fairchild. She does the Hollywood shows a lot. And so we have lunch and talk once a week or something. So it's like, you know, I can't think of anybody that I've been that fangirl attracted to meet. I will say that when I did the New York Comic Con, they positioned me between Carrie Fisher and Julianne Moore. So my table was between the two. I loved both of them. I really loved the artist who Carrie Fisher was. Mm-hmm. And Julianne Moore is one of my favorite actresses. So I fangirl Julianne Moore, I think, a little bit. I was thrilled that they thought enough of me to put me between them. So, you know, I would say Julianne Moore comes the closest to fangirl.
What is one thing that the fans would be surprised to know about you?
Well, so one of the things, some fans know this and most don't, is that in the 80s, when my ingenue career began to slow down a little bit, and I was with Delaney and we were making music, I went to sleep one night and dreamed that I was a photographer. And I woke up the next day, got myself a camera, called a couple of actor friends of mine, and started shooting some headshots. I never took a photography class. In my dreams, I have learned to drive and to shoot. Now, I have pictures of myself as a little child running around the yard at like 8, 9, 10, 11 with a camera around my neck. So somewhere in my subconscious, I always knew I would be, I would shoot photography. Uh-huh. And by the way, this is way before digital was even thought of. So one had to know how to measure light and understand light and know how to make people look good. So in the 80s and the early 90s, I photographed people like Mark Cuban, Willie Nelson, Robert Duvall. I photographed models in Dallas for Neiman Marcus, New York City, Paris, London. And I had a very fabulous career as a photographer. I still have a photo studio in my home. And so I continue to enjoy shooting people. I do a couple of sessions a month now because I'm older and it's hard work, but I just still love shooting. And I don't think too many people know that I still do that or had that kind of career as a photographer.
That is wonderful. Do you have a website?
People can see my work on Facebook. I have a Suze Lanier photography page on Facebook. I started one on Instagram. It's mostly a word of mouth business. I'm not trying to shoot 10 people a day like I used to when I was younger. I'd like to do a couple of them a month and that's about it. Because I am focused back on doing theater. I'm writing a script and a book. And I don't want photography to distract me from my bucket list of things I want to finish. So if somebody hears that I'm a photographer, they'll call and they'll go, hey, you want to, will you shoot me? Sure, come over. I'm set up. But I'm not trying to be a big Hollywood photographer at this age. You know, it's up and down ladders and stuff like that. So I don't have a website. That's the answer. A long answer to a short question. I am on Twitter under Suze Lanier Bramlett. My acting name is Susan Lanier, and I do my music under Suze Lanier Bramlett. My music's available on iTunes and all the music formats, and I'm getting ready to release a new EP, and I'm putting together a new cabaret show to do in New York City.
Oh, congratulations. You'll have to let me know when you're in New York.
I would love to. I'm going to probably work down in the village at one of the collaborations that I'm in communication with. So I hope you're in town when I do it.
I can definitely come down and fangirl at you.
Great. And I would love to see you in the flesh. We'll go at lunch, dinner, whatever.
Listen, Susan, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, Lauren, thanks for inviting me. And I hope that we meet soon.
Once again, a big thank you to Susan Lanier for spending time with us for Halloween weekend on the Not the Final Girl podcast. Check out Susan's Facebook page, which is Suze Lanier Bramlett. You can also find her tweeting on Twitter at Suze Lanier Bramlett. On Instagram, she is Susan_Lanier_actor. I'll link all that information in the show notes as usual. You can find me on Instagram at LaurenMarieTaylor1. That's the number one behind my name. Oh, and don't forget, my website is up and running. It's LaurenMarieTaylor.com. Happy Halloween to a few friends of the podcast, Tom, Julie, and Anne, and a super spooky Halloween to you all. Thanks for listening, liking, and subscribing, everybody. Don't forget to keep your doors locked and stay out of the woods.